Let's move on. Can I give the floor, please, to Sue Loy, the vice chair of the board? Sue's going to give us an update on some of the board's activities. Sue, over to you, please.
Thanks, Bill. Firstly, welcome, everybody. It's nice to see you. Unfortunately, only on the screen, but albeit still good to see you. There's an agenda paper that was circulated. The good news is that I'm not going to go through the slide deck, which is quite long, but rather just highlight a few of the things that we've been working on. So firstly, on the technical front, as you may know, we have finished a couple of changes to our standards, which were urgent, and we managed to get them done on time despite the COVID situation. So at the end of June, we published the amendments to the new insurance standard, IFRS 17, including deferring the effective date to 2023. And also importantly, in August, we published the final part of our amendments to help people who are amending their contracts and their hedging relationships as a result of the IBOR benchmark rate reform amendments going on around the world. And that's really to the credit of the staff that we got that done on time, but also to the credit of our stakeholders who have really stepped up and given us thoughtful comments in expedited timeframes, for example, with IBOR, despite the COVID situation. One thing that we've been very conscious of is making sure that the consultations that we're putting out, both the volume of them and the amount of time people have got to deal with them, is taking account of the difficult circumstances that people are dealing with from a financial reporting perspective. As you may know, we extended the comment periods on a number of our consultations, which are out for comment at the moment. The one, primary financial statements, which is just closed, goodwill and impairment, and our SME consultation. We've also agreed to extend the comment period on our business combinations under common control document when it goes out to a 270-day comment period. And we have slightly postponed the publication date of rate regulation exposure draft and the management commentary exposure draft, again with a view to trying to stagger our consultations a little bit and to accommodate the difficult circumstances that people are dealing with. One important discussion that we had at last week's board meeting was on the timing of the post-implementation reviews of a couple of our newer standards, the revenue recognition standard, IFRS 15, and my favourite IFRS standard, IFRS 9, the new financial instrument standard. We talked last week about what the best timing would be for those to make sure that we've got enough feedback to really make informed decisions about whether those standards are working the way intended. The board decided that we should start the classification and measurement part of the review of IFRS 9 soon. So I expect that in December, the staff will bring the board a proposal for how we will approach the classification and measurement review. But the board agreed that mainly to facilitate more time series analysis, the post-implementation review of IFRS 15 and the expected credit loss and hedge accounting requirements of IFRS 9 will start slightly later on. So we'll come back and confirm the timing of that at a later date. Last but not least, on the consultation front, we talked last week about the agenda consultation document and its content. And just to remind you, the plan is to publish the agenda consultation, where we'll ask our stakeholders for their input on what our priorities should be for the next 5 years in Q1 next year. So that's the main things happening on the technical publication front. Now, Lee just mentioned another important document that was finalised in August, and it's one that sort of straddles Lee's world and Neely's world, if you like, and that's the Due Process Handbook. So that's a document that was reviewed by a subcommittee of the trustees, the Due Process Oversight Committee, and they updated it. But it's got a few important things in there that affect the way that we do our standard setting. So I just wanted to highlight the main things there. The first thing that the new Due Process Handbook does is it updates the commentary around the effects analysis. And this is actually important, I think, for the Advisory Council, because you have given us input in the past about the importance of the effects analysis. And the Due Process Handbook reinforces the importance of effects analysis and also makes the important point that effects analysis is something that we think about right through the standard setting process, right from something when something's in the research phase, all the way to finalisation. And the Due Process Handbook reinforces that idea. The other important area of amendment in the new due process handbook is around the topic of agenda decisions coming from the Interpretations Committee. And these have become an increasingly important part of our toolbox for supporting consistent application over the last few years. And so there's a couple of important changes in the handbook that I wanted to highlight. Firstly, we've confirmed what an agenda decision is and made the point that an agenda decision can't change existing IFRS requirements, but derives its authority from referring to existing requirements. Because they refer to existing requirements, the due process handbook now confirms that to be compliant with IFRS requirements, you need to apply relevant agenda decisions. Because of the importance of agenda decisions that follows from that, we've introduced an additional step into the due process around agenda decisions. So now, prior to the finalisation of an agenda decision, the board will officially confirm an agenda decision and has a right to negative clearance of agenda decisions. So that's an important additional due process step. The next couple of things I wanted to talk about was our conference and also some personnel changes at the board table. So firstly, in the conference, so obviously we're all adapting to this strange new environment where we meet our friends on screen rather than in person, not the same. But one benefit we have found is that in a way we can reach more people through remote connection, and that can be an advantage for an international organisation. And I think one really good example of this was our conference, which we held at the end of September in combination with our big global standard setting World Standard Setters Conference. We combined those two conferences for the first time, and we took them fully online. So what happened as a result of that was actually really great. We ended up with the highest number of participants we've ever had, around 500 participants from 101 different jurisdictions. So the biggest spread of participants that we've ever had in that type of event. So we saw the real benefits of an online environment from a conference perspective. Lastly, I said I'd touch on personnel changes. One of the strange things being on the board is the fact that we all have fixed terms, so we have to say goodbye to our friends and hello to new friends from time to time. And we've been going through a little bit of those changes recently. So two of our long-standing board members, Gary Kubrick from the US and Daryl Scott from Africa, have just retired, having finished their second term on the board. We were sorry to see them both go, but we are pleased to see two fantastic new board members join us. One, Zach Gast, is joining us from the US. He has a very strong investor background, so we're really delighted now to have two investors on the board, which is really important given the objective of our standard setting. And also to replace Daryl, we have Bruce McKenzie, who's joining us from South Africa. He came from owning his own advisory firm. He was a member of the Interpretations Committee. And importantly, he's got a lot of first-hand experience helping people actually implement IFRS standards. So we're really pleased to have that perspective at the board table as well, including, of course, both their geographic and jurisdictional contacts in the US and in Africa. So with that, that was what I wanted to touch on, and very happy to take any questions if we have time.
Sue, thank you very much. Let's do this. The floor is open. Sue, if it's okay, I'll ask for people's interventions and then ask for your response after we hear from a few advisory council members. First, let's hear from Martin. Good day, Martin. Over to you, please. I don't hear Martin. I suspect he might have his mute button on. Martin Boss. Okay, Martin can't hear. I'm not sure if it's a technical issue or if it's your mute, but we're going to come back to you. I haven't forgotten. Let's hear from Garth, please. Garth, over to you.
Okay, I don't know if it's going to be the same question that Martin was going to ask, but it's just in relation to agenda decisions, because this is a question I've been asking for a while, is where does one get where does easily one get all the agenda decisions? Because now that this decision has been made, presumably this applies retrospectively to all agenda decisions made over all the years. Now, is one required to go back to all the IFRIC updates over all the years, or is it intended that these will be included in the ISB books? So that's my question.
All right, Garth, thank you. Thank you very much. Martin, was that your question, or would you like to come in at this point? All right. Still trying to iron out those technical issues. Let's hear from Osman, please. Over to you, Osman.
Thanks, Bill, and hi, Sue. So you touched a little bit on IFRS 9, and unfortunately, I kind of lost the audio for a little bit, but I think you said that the post-implementation review timing is going to be slightly pushed out, a bit further out, if I understood correctly. Just prompted a thought, really. I guess, you know, you will have heard, and certainly I've heard from S&P analysts, but also in the market more generally, about, you know, the lot of head scratching that's going on with regard to IFRS 9 disclosures, particularly with regard to credit losses. Clearly, you know, we haven't had full year-end disclosures yet, and that's part of the problem. And maybe that could be part of the scope for the post-implementation review about the frequency of credit loss disclosures. But I think, you know, there seems to be a really wide variety of outcomes in provisioning, which can't seem to be fully explained by differences in banks' portfolios. So I just wonder whether the board is kind of giving any thought to more consistent application of existing IFRS 9 standards, and then more back to the PIR, whether there's any thought to the frequency of disclosures for IFRS 9.
Thank you very much for that, Osman. Martin is back. Martin, over you to you, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, hear you just fine. There you are.
Okay, thank you. I have a question for Sue on the agenda decisions. I just wonder, do all the past agenda decisions meet the criteria that have been updated, and what happens to them if they don't?
Thanks for that, Martin. We're going to, Sue, after I've got a question here from Bi Leng, and after we hear from Bi Leng, I'll turn it back to you, if that's okay. Bi Leng, please.
I think her question was the same as Garth.
Yes, I see that. So okay, sorry. I was...
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. So agenda decisions, always a favourite topic for everybody, wherever I go, all around the world. So the agenda decisions, I'm pleased people are paying attention to them. The short answer is that in the bound volume of the IFRS standards, the annotated version, they include all of the agenda decisions that have been published that are still outstanding. So if you have a look in that document, that's the easiest way to find them. And they are sort of positioned in the relevant spot. If you're reading the standard, you'll see an annotation that will take you to an agenda decision that relates to the particular requirements that you're reading. What we're also trying to do as we publish new agenda decisions over time is to actually issue now compilations of agenda decisions throughout the year so that they're easier to access over time as well. So we're trying to improve visibility given their importance. In terms of do they all qualify, the answer is yes, Martin, and that's partly because in the past, agenda decisions used to be very, very short. They tended to just say the committee decided that no standard setting was required. It's only in more recent times that they've become more fulsome, and those ones do meet the requirements in terms of not going beyond what the requirements already said. What they really do is just remind you which paragraphs to read and apply to answer a particular question, a financial reporting question. Now, Osman, my other favourite topic, expected credit losses. We are, and me individually, am particularly interested in the quality of the expected credit loss disclosures at the moment in this COVID environment. And if you want to have a chat to me offline, I'd love to hear what you're seeing. One of the reasons why we have decided to wait a little while with the PIR of the ECL part of IFRS 9, and by a little while, I don't mean many, many years, but a bit longer than right now, is because we think that the information that we're going to get through this sort of COVID environment is going to be fairly instructive for us in terms of whether the expected credit loss model acted in the way that we anticipated in terms of being timely in reflecting changes in credit risk expectations. We're also really aware that IFRS 9's only really just started to be applied. And so we are already seeing people starting to work on improving their disclosures. We always expected a period of time where people would make their disclosures and then sort of look around and see what their peers were doing and to adjust their practices. And we think that process is still going on. Also, we know regulators are focusing on the quality of disclosures and trying to take actions where necessary to improve the quality of disclosure. And we want some of that practice to sort of pan out a little bit more before we start making adjustments. Having said all of that, of course, if there are challenges with the existing disclosures, we are very keen to hear about them. I myself have been involved in some discussions to try and reinforce the objective-based nature of the disclosures in IFRS 7. I've been encouraging investors to ask questions of preparers because the IFRS 7 requirements are written in a way where investors are supposed to have information that enables them to understand particular things. So if you are not enabled, you've got the right to ask questions, and I really encourage people to do that because preparers often tell me that nobody's ever asked them the question. But we are really interested to understand whether the disclosure package is working for investors or not, what is working, what isn't working, where regulators have acted, what's helped in terms of improving the quality of disclosures. And we're interested in that not just for the PIR of IFRS 9, but also because, as you know, we're working on a package of new disclosure requirements for IFRS 13 and IAS 19, our pension standard, where we're trying to test whether more objective-based disclosures works well. And the information we get from IFRS 9 is one piece of evidence for how well or otherwise objective-based disclosures work. So any information people have to share with us, we're already interested to hear, is the short answer.
Sue, thank you very much. Before we move on, can I ask B. Leng, I'm afraid maybe I didn't allow you to ask your question earlier. Do you have a question, B. Leng?
Yeah, thank you, Bill. On the agenda decision, I'm just thinking whether if we have too many agenda decisions, whether that would drive to a prescriptive-based standard rather than a principle-based standard, and whether will that actually jeopardize, you know, the judgment, exercise of judgment. The other question, I'm just thinking whether if there are too many agenda decision issued on a particular standard, would there be would it indicate that the standards have not been clearly drafted?
It might. If you're okay for me to answer, Bill. For me as a standard setter, I think it's fantastic being on the Interpretations Committee because it gives us a lot of information about how particular styles of drafting work or don't work in terms of clarity and consistency of application. So it's almost like a feedback process for us. So I think it's something we do need to be aware of, and something that we're conscious of in terms of the timing of PIRs is because the Interpretations Committee is more active, and because we've had transition resource groups, we're getting earlier information where people do have application questions. So I think it is a potential source of information for us, and we should be aware of that. In terms of do we have too many agenda decisions, I think there's a couple of things there. We're always trying to get the balance right between being helpful enough to support consistent application and not so helpful that we're actually disruptive or move to a rules-based system. I think the main sort of protection we have to try and balance that is the fact that we do have criteria for questions to come into the Interpretations Committee. You know, there has to be evidence of diversity in practice. We need to have some sort of parameters to make sure that it's a real question in practice that affects enough entities that it's worth answering the question. And I think that's our main protection that we have, that we don't go too far. But at the moment, I think the strategy is to believe that agenda decisions do assist in the really important strategic objective of really getting consistent application and having a single set of standards in practice, not just sort of in words. And so we do think they're important, but it's something we do need to constantly monitor. And the agenda consultation, one of the things is, you know, have we got the balance right, the amount of time we spend doing this stuff, maintenance versus new stuff. And so you get a chance to comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. That was really, that was thorough. That was very interesting. Okay, let's move on. We are on agenda item 3.
Excuse me, Bill. I think Martin might have come in with a question as well, if that's okay.
Martin, I almost skipped over you. I apologize. Please, no, Martin. Go on.
Thanks for the question for Sue. I guess you just mentioned that the target is a consistent application with regard to the agenda decisions, and they are coming more and more, and also now. There's a kind of board opportunity to reject an agenda decision. So that also highlights the importance of these kinds of agenda decisions and the reason why they are finally done. Now, talking from a preparer's perspective, not necessarily from our perspective, but also from many other preparers, the question is where to find the agenda decisions. And if you are a technical expert, you know where to find agenda decisions if you go back year on year and then try to find them. And they are also in the Green Book. But on the other hand, this is something you have to pay for. And with regard to enforcers, what they do, they base their decision also with regard to their final judgments on agenda decisions and use these agenda decisions. So I guess from the ISB perspective, one should consider whether also there should be a separate place for agenda decisions which are easier to access. That's a simple way. I know that it's also a way to make, to generate some revenue for the ISB with the Green Booklet. But overall, if you say the ISB is a standard setter with a worldwide acceptance, it's important to have free access.
But they are all also on the website. So if you go to this, and you know. I don't want to sound defensive because I know it is very important to have this visibility, and we're trying to think of ways to make sure it is sufficiently visible, particularly now that we've been very clear how important they are. But if you go to the supporting implementation part of our website, there's an analysis by standard. And if you go on there, you can find all of the agenda decisions that relate to a particular standard by standard. Now, you still need to be a bit of a nerd to know that. I acknowledge that, but we are trying to find ways where you don't have to pay money to access it. But we're always open to more ideas for visibility as well, if you have any things.
Thanks.
Before we move on, thank you for that, Martin and Sue. And Udi, let's hear from you, please.
Thank you, Bill. One thing, Sue, that you didn't mention, but it was on the presentation, was the thing regarding IS-28 and the equity method. My question, and looking at the paper and the decision of the board to take the narrow scope project, is the board thinking maybe to issue a discussion paper, since there one of the alternatives is even to eliminate one of the alternatives that the board didn't take is to eliminate the IS-28. And this is something that I've heard a lot in practice. So maybe the board is considering also to ask the question, is it still something that needs to be done, IS-28? Thank you.
It's a good question.
So the
research is at very early stage for this project. So just last week, we sort of gave advice to the board and us to the staff in terms of what the approach should be. So the staff had recommended we do an approach which is relatively focused and more looking at the application questions we've got and trying to answer those questions using the existing framework. So the idea that we're working with at the moment is not sort of fundamentally rethinking whether or not there should be an equity method, rather working with it, because a lot of stakeholders, I think, quite like the equity method and trying to deal with application questions. But we did emphasise very much that this was sort of the approach the staff should investigate. So it's early stages. We'll see how successful it is. And no matter what we do, it will come out for comment. And so that gives people the opportunity to say, actually, we don't agree with this path. But at the moment, the approach is working with IS 28 and being fairly focused on applications for the moment.
Okay. All right, Sue, thank you very much.